This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. In the early morning hours of February 2, 2019, TSA agent Robert Henry jumped to his death from the 10th floor of the Hyatt Hotel inside Orlando International Airport. He wrote in a suicide note email to friends that he couldn't help but make himself a target of management. He finished the email, quote, "Tell my managers I'll be waiting for them in hell, especially the ones who feel this was necessary." The question since, why did Robert Henry kill himself? Well, new documents obtained by WMFE helped to shed some light on this. An investigation by WMFE released this year called TSA in Turmoil documented allegations that Henry was bullied by co-workers and was targeted by managers, and that this was a major issue at Orlando International Airport and other airports across the country. That reporting was done by WMFE's Danielle Pryor and Abe Abariah. They join me now. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So as part of that reporting, WMFE put in a Freedom of Information Act request for the TSA's death investigation into Robert Henry. We now have that document and it will be made available on our website as well. Danielle, before we get into the document, remind us, who was Rob Henry?
Well, he was a TSO at Orlando International Airport, and he was 36 at the time of his death. He actually jumped from the 10th floor of the Hyatt Regency Hotel at the Orlando International Airport on February 2nd, and I was there covering that event that day, and it was chaos. People had seen him jump. People had thought it was a gun. It was a bomb. They run through the checkpoint and then had to go through it all over again. So flights were delayed, and people were very shaken when I got to them. And that was about an hour after it happened.
Right. There have been a lot of questions about what happened to Robert Henry leading up to the suicide. Abe, what do we know now because of this death investigation that TSA has released?
Well, the report confirmed some key details in the morning on February 2nd. Henry had gone from an overnight shift to one where he worked very early in the morning, and he wasn't doing well with that transition. So he was working in a room where the TSA officers are looking at screens when he was accused of falling asleep. And falling asleep on the job is a really big deal. It's called a one-step, and TSA officers can be fired on the spot for falling asleep on the job.
Right, but that didn't happen to Rob Henry.
That's right. The lead officer in charge of Henry says she had seen him fall asleep on the job twice before. On the second time, she reported it to her supervisor. Now, that supervisor reassigned Henry to an area where he'd be standing up. That way, he couldn't fall asleep again. So, am I making sense so far?
Sure. So the lead over Rob Henry had reported that he fell asleep to the supervisor. The supervisor didn't take that disciplinary action.
Right. And now, the morning of February 2nd at 6:10 a.m., the same lead officer says she again saw Henry fall asleep. And that, according to her, was the third time. So, at 7 a.m., she went over the supervisor's head and went to managers. So on the morning of February 2nd, Henry had a meeting with three managers, and he signed a statement saying he'd closed his eyes, quote, "as a reaction to a flare-up of pain I've had since just prior to the start of the government shutdown." And that was because he was having some dental issues, and he hadn't actually gone to a dentist yet.
Right. And as a reminder, looking back at February, this was when the government shutdown was in full swing.
Absolutely. And TSA agents in particular were required to go to work, but they were not getting a paycheck. Mm-hmm. So 9 a.m., Henry fills out paperwork saying he's going to go home because of this toothache, and according to the managers, he left the office holding his cheek in his hands. And the managers say Henry was told to take as much time as he needed to feel better. He was also told by management that they would start looking into allegations that he'd fallen asleep on the job. Instead of leaving for the dentist, though, 30 minutes later, he emails a suicide note and he jumps from the 10th floor of the Hyatt Hotel inside the airport.
Now, to be clear, we don't know the names of all the witnesses in the report that TSA has provided to WMFE.
That's correct. The names of almost all the witnesses interviewed have been redacted for privacy.
Okay, but the report does give us some more clarity on an official count of what happened that morning. Well, Danielle, what about the reporting that we've done at WMFE with multiple co-workers saying Henry was bullied at work?
Well, that was one of the several angles that investigators looked at, Matt. But ultimately, they concluded there was no definitive evidence that Rob Henry had committed suicide because he was bullied or because of the government shutdown. Now, we should say we reached out to TSA several times for a comment, and no one's talked to us yet about the report. But as you can imagine, the reactions to this report have not been great. Deb Hanna, who represents the union for TSA workers at Orlando International Airport, says she was disgusted by the report. She says people are really mad because the report just reinforces what they already believed about TSA, that this was the conclusion the agency was going to come to regardless of what officers actually said.
When I just printed that out and read it, and I got about halfway through and I just threw it on the table because I was angry and I was frustrated and I just didn't want to read any more because it's nothing. It's just a cover-up. That's all it is.
Definitely not mincing her words there. I understand you also spoke with Sylvia Henry, Rob Henry's mother. What was her reaction?
Well, she wasn't surprised by the report because she'd seen an earlier copy of it.
TSA is investigating TSA, and I'm not sure that the truth, the whole truth, can come out when an organization is investigating itself.
Sylvia Henry says she wants conditions to improve for other TSA workers as well.
But I would like to see improvement of conditions for TSA workers, for them to have a supportive management that allows them to be trained and be effective in their jobs and do their jobs as best they can to protect the flying public.
I also spoke with Mark Zaid, the attorney who's representing the Henry family, and some of our listeners might recognize his name because he's representing the whistleblower in the impeachment hearing. And he basically said the TSA was very professional through the process and sympathetic with the family. The family was able to see the report before it was released. And here's how he reacted to the top-line conclusion that there was no direct evidence that bullying contributed to Rob's suicide.
Well, some of the biggest problems are that a lot of the individuals may not have been willing to come forward and discuss what they saw. There was some evidence of the bullying, and we certainly had received reports of it privately, but I can understand, having represented federal employees for 2.5 decades, that many of them were not willing to tell investigators what they might have seen. So it is unfortunate when that happens, but it's not surprising.
So Mark Zaid, the attorney for the family there, and obviously the family taking issue and pushing back at the idea that bullying was not a factor in the suicide. But what about that role of the government shutdown?
Well, Zaid says that for some of the really big questions, there just might never be a clear answer.
Clearly, the shutdown had an impact on him, as it did so many federal employees who weren't being paid during that time period. And it definitely contributed to the anxiety that he was experiencing at the time, which ultimately apparently led to the suicide. But for a lot of these questions, there's just suppositions based on whatever evidence that could be compiled. But I think this is one of those that it's going to remain unknown.
Rob Henry's suicide, as we've spoken about, was very public. Now that we have a public report about his death investigation beyond the union, how are those findings being taken by TSA workers at Orlando International Airport?
Well, we also talked with Stan Tucholsky, who knew Rob for more than a decade as a friend and a colleague at Dulles International Airport and then at Orlando International Airport. And he said he wasn't surprised by the report's findings, but he said he would have liked an unredacted version to be released, as most TSA workers' names have been blanked out in the report.
So there's those questions. It's like, who actually said this and why was this being said kind of things.
Stan Tucholsky says he wasn't surprised by these findings. He says he never thought the shutdown actually played a role in Rob's death. But he does think that what happened to Rob the morning of February 2nd, where he was brought into a meeting with managers after he was found asleep in the OSARP, was a factor.
I believe that a bullying factor and a intimidation factor of meeting managers could largely have caused whatever caused him to, on that day, decide to go to the 10th floor.
So getting back to this report, there was also this sort of mystery surrounding what had happened to Robert Henry's airport badge. What did the report tell us, if anything, about that?
Well, that was a big question for family members and people who were following the case closely. Henry's badge was not brought with the body to the coroner's office. So there was this speculation that maybe Henry was fired on the spot, that his badge was taken from him that morning, and maybe that was the final straw that led to his death. Now, we were able to confirm through public records requests that his badge was deactivated 5 days after his death. And this report now says the badge was taken off of Henry's body by a first responder, specifically a Customs and Border Patrol agent who took the badge off and gave it to an EMT, and then the badge was later returned. Here's Stan Tucholsky. He's talking about that badge.
It just seemed like nobody wanted to admit what happened to it, and nobody seemed to know a chain of command of it and was readily willing to divulge anything.
Danielle, the report also detailed other disciplinary incidents that Rob had had at work, right?
It did, although the details of some of the incidents have been redacted. For example, it says a manager was collecting statements on Rob's performance before his death, and that an assistant federal security director had sat down and had an informal meeting with Rob in 2018.
So what about the workplace at Orlando International Airport? What's changed?
Well, Stan's a good person to talk to about this because he currently works at the airport. Now, remember back in April after Henry's suicide, there were big leadership changes at the airport, including Federal Security Director Jerry Henderson being put on leave. Now, TSA says this was not in reaction to Rob Henry's suicide, but Stan Tucholsky says it points to an overall toxic workplace for TSA workers at the airport.
Some of those very people have they're no longer working in the direct workforce at MCO with officers and everything. They've gone on to other positions, or they have left Orlando, or they've relocated to other work areas.
And Stan Tucholsky says the report didn't necessarily clear Rob's name. He also says that in his view, there's a segment of management that still exists from the old regime, and it's trying to resist, and it's trying to enforce things in the way it used to. Still, Stan says things are better now. He said there's also been a change in the workplace culture by current Federal Security Director Pete Garcia and Assistant Federal Security Director Greg Hawko. And at the national level, there's a conversation for the first time about mental health.
TSA nationally has instituted a suicide prevention type of awareness and program that is rolling out and training and everything. So it was an issue that obviously was being ignored not only here in MCO but across the nation.
And Deb Hanna, who represents the union, says there's been a culture change in Orlando.
I think that the one thing that helped was that the officers aren't afraid now to bring stuff out. So if something happens, they're filing harassment, they're filing an EEO, they're calling their union reps, or they're bringing it to the AFSD. And before that wouldn't have happened.
All right, so let's talk about legacy. What are people saying about how Rob Henry will be remembered?
Well, Stan Tucholsky, who's still working at MCO as a TSO, says Rob's death has started a conversation around bullying at the airport, and he calls Rob Henry a guardian angel.
I choose to believe that his sacrificing his life caused people to stop and take notice and pause and look into and investigate, and that in the long run, there will be more positive change and things will be for the better. And that's how I remember him.
And he says there isn't a day that goes by that people don't talk about Rob.
So what happens now that the report is out there? What's next for the family?
Well, we posed that question to the family's attorney, Mark Zaid.
There's no lawsuit that's being planned. I mean, what the family certainly would want is to achieve some level of closure, and I think to at least try and find some meaning in this tragedy. And that one thing that will be pursued is to see if we can get Congress interested in additional oversight of TSA and the climate down in Orlando. And again, to look into it to make sure that something like this never happens again. So there is advocacy that can come out of this tragedy to hopefully serve as a lesson for how TSA controls and monitors its workforce.
And I think one outcrop of this has been there's at least some acknowledgement from TSA that suicide is an issue for its employees. So the TSA is hiring a contractor to do suicide prevention training. And reporting on Rob's suicide helped the agency to realize it was an issue. That's actually what they put in the RFP. So here's Zaid again.
Clearly, something needs to be done. And this is definitely a first step for TSA and its managers, and no doubt throughout the federal government. You know, will it be enough? That's hard to say. I'm sure there's some level of not expecting TSA to be able to prevent every type of situation that might arise with something like this. You need specialized training, etc. But clearly there has to be something done, And we're encouraged, at least, that TSA is taking those initial steps.
Right. So the attorney, Mark Zaid, said that they do want to try and get Congress more involved in oversight there. What role does Congress play in all of this?
Well, there is an oversight committee that looks into TSA. And so the family wants to get, a letter to lawmakers who are on that committee and possibly have some hearings there to be able to talk about it. They want to talk about the issue of workplace bullying. They also want to talk about more fundamental issues like pay. And there's also the sort of issue about whether or not TSA employees are sort of treated the same as other federal employees and whether they should get some broader protections there. Here's what Sylvia Henry, Rob Henry's mother, had to say about this as well.
His legacy, well, to us, for once, for me, he's my precious son and will always be. He that rests is, I pray he rests in peace. They cannot hurt him anymore. No one can hurt him anymore. Nothing here on this planet can hurt him anymore.
We've been talking about the death of Robert Henry. He's a TSA agent who jumped to his death inside Orlando International Airport February 2nd this year. Since then, an investigation by WMFE, TSA in Turmoil, documented allegations that Henry was bullied by co-workers and targeted by managers, and that this was an issue at airports across the country. And that reporting was done by WMFE's Danielle Pryor and Abe Abariah. They've been speaking with us. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Still to come, medical debt can be crippling, so a church in Florida decided to do something about it. A conversation with the pastor of Access Church in Lakeland, where the congregation helped clear $1.6 million in debt for more than 1,300 people. That's after the break. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Just before Thanksgiving, 1,300 families in Lakeland were mailed letters to let them know their medical debts had been paid. The congregation of Access Church partnered with a non-profit to figure out how much medical debt there was among Lakeland residents with incomes below 50% of the federal poverty line. And they paid off about half of it to the tune of $1.6 million. Well, Jason Burns is the lead pastor at Access Church in Lakeland. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's an honor to be with you.
Jason, it's a story that's really gotten a lot of headlines and I think really hit a nerve with many people. I wonder if you could sort of walk us back through the decision you came to with the congregation to spend some of the charitable giving that the church spends each year on paying off medical debts. How did that idea come up?
Absolutely. Well, every year we receive a special offering from the members of our church, and every penny of it goes out the doors to meet needs. And we receive it in the Christmas season because it's the season of giving. And then we use that money proactively the following year to just meet needs in the city and around the world. So we meet needs like building homes for people that are less fortunate in other countries, building churches. But this year, just through the generosity of our church, we had so much money available to give. And we had this idea. We've seen several other churches partner with an organization to eliminate medical debt that's owed by people that live at less than half of the national poverty line. And so we contacted that company and found out that in the city of Lakeland, there was over $3 million of debt that had reached that level of deferment. And so as a church, we just stepped up and we did about half of it.
And that's pretty remarkable. You're talking about folks who are really, really struggling to get by. What was the sort of discussion in the congregation when you said, yeah, this is what we're going to do to spend this money on this gift this year?
Yeah, well, we have a team of people in our church that helps to make all of those decisions. And so when we announced it to the church, I mean, they freaked out. I mean, it's such an amazing thing that all of us together can make such an amazing difference through our combined generosity. And so they loved it.
Jason, you know a little bit about medical debt yourself. You had a personal story, so this story kind of hits home to you too, right?
Well, 6 months into my marriage, my beautiful new wife was diagnosed with stage 2 non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and thankfully we had good health insurance in that season, but I kept all of our receipts from all of our bills, and it totaled over $5 million. And so I just think, what would it have done to us if we didn't have insurance in that season? And then when you add that to the fact that the people that we were able to donate to and help live at such a low level of income, I mean, that debt is staggering. That will weigh on them for the rest of their lives.
Mm-hmm. Have you heard from any of the folks that you've helped? I know there are some restrictions because of, you know, federal regulations that you can't identify those people, and that's, you're fine with that. But has anybody reached out and said, yeah, this is going to help us out through the Christmas season and beyond?
No, not yet, because letters are just going out just now. And so we expect that over the next few days, we'll hear from people for sure. But really, that was never the heart of this. First of all, like you said, we don't know who the people are. This organization we work with uses some sort of algorithm to figure out who those people are. We just like giving, and we believe that it's only giving when there's no strings attached. And so we just give open-handedly and hope that it blesses people as we approach the holidays.
Have you learned something that you didn't know before about the Lakeland community going about this process of figuring out what to, you know, give that money, what organization to give that money to, or what, who to give that to? And I'm wondering sort of what you've learned about the community that you didn't know before.
Well, I haven't learned a lot about the city of Lakeland. Lakeland, I know your primary audience is Orlando. Lakeland is an amazing, thriving city. I mean, it's brimming with culture and excitement. It's an amazing place. So I didn't learn a lot about the city. What I learned about more was even the hearts of our people. What I've learned is that money is a magnifier. So when you get money, what it does is it just makes you more of whatever you were. So if you're a generous person, getting more money just makes you more generous. If you're stingy, getting more money just makes you hold onto it even tighter. The more I talk about the generosity of our church and the more that I talk about the ways that our giving is changing our city and changing the world, the more I see people come with excitement ready to give because they see the difference their money is making.
Have you had other organizations reach out to you in the aftermath of this? I know it's gotten a lot of attention on social media. Are other organizations like the group that you partnered up with to figure out this medical debt and say, you know, folks who might be saying, yeah, look, there are other areas of need. We're happy to partner with this church as well.
We haven't really heard from other organizations. We have a lot of strategic partnerships that we donate throughout the year. It's funny because this story about eliminating the medical debt, this hit national news. It kind of surprised us, but we're always doing stuff like this. This one just had a big headline to it, but we're always giving. And so because of the Christmas offering that we receive every year, we're able to be proactive. So traditional churches, they'll see a need. I'll make up an example, like a hurricane or a tornado or an earthquake will hit. And then a church will see it. They'll see the devastation. And then the next Sunday, they'll give together and then they'll send off money. Because of the Christmas offering, what we're able to do is proactively give. So there have been times that hurricanes have been heading towards an area that we knew was going to devastate the area. And we were able to proactively give to an organization like Convoy of Hope or others who were going to be there on the ground with supplies, with food, with medicine, with blankets, with generators, with whatever is needed to help the people in the immediate aftermath of it. And so through the generosity of our church, we're able to be proactive. And then secondly, we've tried to create a church where we're not always asking people for money. And so because of that, this allows our people to give one time and then to feel like throughout the year that when they invite their friends, we're never going to shake them down for money.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty talking with Jason Burns. He's the lead pastor of Access Church in Lakeland. The church recently made headlines by surprising more than 1,300 folks in the Lakeland area and helping pay off their medical debts to the tune of about $1.6 million. Jason, tell me a little bit about your church. I mean, talking about some of the activities that you all do, it sounds like people are pretty active in their community, that they have this instinct to get involved and try and make a difference in people's lives. What's the congregation like? Is it a fairly young congregation? Are you growing? Are you kind of finding more people joining this church?
Oh, we're growing like crazy. We call our church a life-giving church. And what that means is we want people to be built up and encouraged, not beaten down. I mean, the world is so full of critics and cynics and haters. We think the church should be the kind of place where you come and you experience life. Like we believe as we read the teachings of Jesus, he said in John chapter 10, I have come that you might have life and life to the fullest or life with abundance. And so we think that that's what the church should be. And so our church is growing like crazy. It's kind of funny. We actually don't even have our own building yet. And that's a part of the story that I think is special, is that even though we don't have our own facility, we're not letting that stop us from giving. I don't think you should ever stop giving based on your circumstances. We're very close to getting our own facility. I'm just believing it's going to happen soon. But in the meantime, we're just giving.
So where do you gather then in the meantime?
So we meet in a public high school. It's George Jenkins High School. And we rent their auditorium and some of their other classrooms for our kids. And it works out great. I mean, we have over 2,000 people in the city of Lakeland call us their church now. And on an average Sunday, we'll have around 1,000 to 1,100 people join us to worship.
And how long has the church been around for?
Yeah, so we started as a college Bible study. It's kind of funny. We didn't intend to start a church. We started, for some of my friends, just a gathering in my living room, and that was about 12 years ago. And then about 2 years into it, we had a couple hundred people coming, and we realized that the people who were coming, this had become their church. And so we said, let's call it what it is. And so 10 years ago, we became a church.
So this was not necessarily a career path that you picked. It just kind of chose you.
Well, I wanted to be a pastor. I just had a different picture of how I would get there. So I thought I would kind of climb the corporate ladder in church. Like I'd start as a youth pastor and then work with college students and eventually work my way to the top. But in the season that my wife had cancer, it was interesting. We felt like our hearts towards the city of Lakeland really changed. And I've always liked Lakeland, but I had this love that I can't explain to you for it. And so we just had all these friends that said they loved God, but just were not connected to the church. And I don't know how you can do that. Like, as I read the Bible, you know, the Bible calls the church the bride of Christ. And I don't know how you can say you love someone but hate their bride. And so we said, well, if this is the case for a lot of people, let's create the kind of church that would honor God and that people would actually love to attend. And so that's what we've done. We've just created a church that we would go to even if we didn't lead it.
And Jason, are you from Lakeland originally, or is this a place that you came to?
I moved to Lakeland in the year 2000 as a college student. I went to Southeastern University and had a great experience there. But before that, I lived in South Florida in West Palm Beach.
Just kind of reflecting on what the church has done this Christmas or this holiday season to help pay off those medical debts, does it kind of make you reflect on sort of what we're doing as a society and maybe things that need to change? Or do you just sort of say, on to the next mission, on to the next kind of task for our church?
You know, what was interesting to me was this story got picked up all over the country, and it's been fun as people have tagged me in Facebook posts and groups where people are talking about it. 95% of the comments are super positive. They're just celebrating the fact that something good was done to bless people. The other 5% have made it something political. They've made it, you know, this is what our country or the government should or should not be doing. And that was never our intention whatsoever. In fact, not one ounce of our heart was political in this at all. It was all just about blessing people open-handedly. Like, I really do believe the only way to live generously is to live with your hands open, meaning whatever resources, money, time, energy, whatever you have, it needs to flow through you, not just stay with you. And so for us, it's always just been about how can we bless people, no strings attached. And again, this is just one example of the amazing things our church gets to do through the Christmas offering.
And what would your message be then to other folks? I mean, we're coming out of Thanksgiving. We're recording this interview on Giving Tuesday, when a time when a lot of people are thinking about charitable organizations they might want to support. But the holiday season can be a tough time for many people, whether they're dealing with medical debt or other issues. What would you say to people who are struggling or people who want to be generous?
Well, first I would say this. I think the holiday season, people don't necessarily have more needs. They just feel it more. I've read and heard that there's more suicides in the Christmas season than the other 11 months combined. I don't think people have more problems. It's like a magnifying glass. It highlights the problems that people feel. I think that what giving does is giving breaks the hold of materialism and greed that has a way of strangleholding our hearts. And so all of us need to give. And so I believe that the church is one of the best places to give through. And the reality is so many people don't trust their churches, and so they don't give. If that's your case, I would say find a church that you love and trust the leadership. Find a church that you believe in the mission so much that you'll sacrifice for. And never give to an organization, but give through an organization. And so as a church at Access, we try really hard to always highlight and to show people, you know, to connect the dots between their giving and the difference it's making in our city and around the world.
Are you and the congregation sort of now thinking ahead to what you might be doing next year, or do you wait until further down the line to think about how the church can make a difference in the community in 2020?
Yeah, well, I would say this. There are certainly some things that are already planned. So we plan on building more homes and doing more things to meet needs around the world in some of the areas where we strategically partner, like Kenya, Tanzania, Honduras, Chiapas, Mexico, and other places. So there's some stuff that we are automatically every year going to give and do. Beyond that, we set aside a certain percentage of the money that comes in to meet needs that we can't predict. Like, we don't know what natural disasters there are going to be. So some of it goes to that. And then beyond that, there's needs that pop up in our church. So for example, we had a family in the church last year that was building a house that they were going to move into. And while the house was being completed, they were living in their parents' house. and that house caught fire and burned down, and literally everything in the house burned with it. And the problem was, because it wasn't their house, they had no insurance on anything. So at the end of that night, all they had was the clothes left on their back. And so as a church, it's amazing to be able to show up with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dollars of gift cards to Walmart and Target and stores that provide food and clothes and just the necessities to even just get through the next day. And so there's a certain amount that we can plan, and then there's a certain amount that we just have to wait and see what needs pop up that allow us to be proactive to meet.
And when are you going to be moving into your new campus or your new church?
Well, we don't have it officially yet. We're hoping to sign any day now. And then my hope would be sometime middle of next year.
Jason Burns is the lead pastor of Access Church in Lakeland. Thank you so much for your time.
Man, it was an honor. Thank you.
Up next, the League of Women Voters of Orange County has been advocating for the rights of voters and educating voters about the issues for 80 years. A conversation about the legacy of the League and the work ahead, that's when Intersection returns. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The League of Women Voters of Orange County has a new book out celebrating the legacy of an organization that's been advocating for political engagement for 80 years. Some of the issues may have changed, but the League is still just as committed to voter education and engagement as it was when it started. I'm joined by Sandy Vidal. She's the president of the League of Women Voters of Orange County. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And we're also joined by Linda Chapin. She's former mayor of Orange County. Thank you so much, Linda.
Delighted to be here. Thank you.
So, Linda, I want to start with you. The League of Women Voters in Orange County has a long history. You're in your 80th anniversary right now?
That's right. We're celebrating the 80th anniversary of the League of Women Voters. And since I joined as a very young woman, in fact, when I moved to Orlando, a friend gave me a membership in the League of Women Voters as a housewarming present. Mm-hmm. And so much of my activities were in my younger days, and it seems hard to believe that now, 40 years later, we're celebrating an 80th anniversary.
Do you think you would have had the political career that you did had you not had that kind of introduction to the League?
It's hard to say. I can certainly attest to the fact that the experience the League gave me, the training they gave me in how to look at issues objectively, how to do research, even the training in public speaking was very useful to me when I decided to go into politics.
Mm-hmm. Now, the book written by Ann Patton is called Warriors for Democracy. It's the story of the League of Women Voters of Orange County, Florida. And it has been a struggle, right? I mean, it's been a fight, first of all, to get the vote for women in the United States. And then there have been many issues that the League has been focused on here in Central Florida, kind of fighting, advocating for.
Well, of course, it is important, especially this year, to look at the convergence of anniversaries, because this year, in 2019, we celebrate the 80th anniversary of the local League. Next year, we celebrate the 100th anniversary of the National League and the suffrage amendment, which gave women the right to vote.
Mm-hmm.
And it is hard for young people today, if you go to a school and talk about these events, it's hard for them to understand that when the country was founded, women were left out in terms of having the same rights and even the right to vote. So this is a significant milestone and a very big celebration next year for the ratification of the 19th Amendment. And it was hard, I think, yes, for women to find their way into the body politic, certainly in Orange County in Central Florida. I was one of the first, not the first, woman to run for public office, but one of the first. And the women who did that were generally League members. They had studied the issues. They felt strongly about the issues. And by the way, it's interesting to me when you look at the book and the history of the League, these were not radical women. These were not fighters. They were very establishment women, the wives of local judges and lawyers. But they felt strongly that it was important for citizens to be educated and involved.
Was there one issue, you know, around the time that the Orange County League was established that really galvanized people and kind of got them involved?
It's probably natural that in those earliest days, women were looking at children's issues and school issues, but they very quickly realized that the only way to solve the problems that they saw
were to educate citizens to demand change. Mm-hmm. And so it's my view, and Sandy can comment on this, that really one of the most important functions the League has had throughout its history, maybe the most important, has been educating voters, registering voters, and getting people to the polls so that the citizens have the right to bring about change. That's what a democracy is all about.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of that, Sandy?
Absolutely. I agree with Linda. Some of the things that happened back in the 40s are pretty interesting, though. One of the things that the League worked on was the improvement for milk safety back in the 1940s, getting milk safe for all of our kids to drink in school. And then one of the other things that was really important was there was a landmark school act in 1947, which was focused on creating one school district per county. Hmm. And that's something that we still have today.
It's also the reason, by the way, that we have the largest school districts in the country, because they are countywide in Florida. And that's been an interesting journey as well.
Yeah, and does it seem to you that school issues are still one of the things that get people most involved in politics, at the local level at least, because they're concerned about not only if they have kids in school, but what's going on in their neighborhood, whether there's a school going up and how is that going to affect traffic and everything?
I think that that's definitely correct. We have a large education committee that really spends a lot of time watching all of the bills and legislation that come down from the Florida legislature. And, you know, recently we've had some conversations and probably heated discussions around charter schools and taking money away from the public schools. We're not opposed necessarily to nonprofit charter schools, but many of those nonprofit charter schools are connected to for-profit entities behind the scenes. And so I think the lack of regulation and the lack of being able to measure apples to apples is something that is really concerning to the League and continues to be something that we're focused on.
And the League's always been involved, as Sandy says, in education issues. But I think that leads us to another observation, which is the thing that the League is particularly good at is looking at systems. Not just how does our school system work in Orange County, Florida, but how does it work in the state of Florida? And what are the implications of laws passed in Tallahassee? And how do you correct things that you think could be done better? And so education is an area in which they look at the systems, even environmental issues, rather than perhaps looking at just what's happening to the Wekiva River. The League looks at the state of Florida and even beyond the state of Florida.
One of the biggest is climate change.
Right.
That's one of the biggest issues that we're focused on.
Has the League been kind of an early champion for focusing on that?
It has been. And really, I think just the environmental effects of what's going on that you can see around things like the water rising, particularly in Florida, we have a lot of environmental issues around algae and red tide and things like that. So the League has been involved in that, really looking, you know, back like we looked at milk safety, we're looking at water safety, making sure not only is our water safe, but that we have enough of it. And so natural resources is something that's really important. There's a lot of discussion going on about the road construction with Split Oak, and the League is at the forefront of those discussions to try to ensure that protected lands stay protected.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty speaking to Sandy Vidal. She's the president of the League of Women Voters of Orange County, and Linda Chapin, former mayor of Orange County. And we're talking about the book Warriors for Democracy. It's the story of the League of Women Voters of Orange County, Florida. Linda, when you look back at the League over the time that you've been involved, what do you think the standout achievements have been? Or is it too difficult to say that? Are there some things kind of more generally that the League has really had some wins on, whether it's voter engagement, whether it's kind of getting people involved and thinking more about democracy and politics, but are there some things that really stick out?
Well, you've just defined how hard it is to determine what are the most important things. I've always felt that getting people involved, educated, and engaged is probably the number one function.
Is it becoming more challenging now, too?
No, I don't think so. I think people are feeling the problems of the day perhaps more keenly than ever before. Mm-hmm. And we're finding that our efforts at outreach and registering, especially with young people, are becoming more and more successful. But perhaps in my mind, or at least in my times, it may be entirely different now. But when I was league president back in the 70s, the issues were about the Florida Constitution. And the league was enormously involved in getting a new constitution for the state of Florida, mm-hmm. which was very overdue, much needed. And so they were a big part of getting the Florida Constitution passed, the new one in 1968, and then continued to be involved in how it evolved after that. But it's been in modern times, as Sandy could tell you, that our actions have become more than research and study. Mm-hmm. We've actually become real activists in addressing issues that go back to the earliest days when we were worried about one man, one person, one vote, mm-hmm. reapportionment issues way back mm-hmm. when. And today it's about fair districts. And the league actually got the Fair Districts Amendment passed and added to the Constitution. And then when the legislature decided to ignore that, the league went to court mm-hmm. and was successful in getting the Supreme Court of Florida to rule in favor of what the citizens had overwhelmingly voted for. That's the important part. Mm-hmm. The league helps citizens understand the issues and take action on the issues. And in modern times, we've defended their decisions.
Sandy, thinking about things like voter engagement and sort of political awareness, what do you think the challenges are to getting people interested in politics and getting them to realize that they can actually have a say in the way things are in Florida?
I think the hardest thing is just getting people to really care about politics. I think there's so much noise right now that it's hard for people to understand that one person can make a huge difference. And so it's really, like Linda said, it's about educating and advocating for people to become interested, continuing to register people to vote, even from the time that they become citizens. Mm-hmm. And for the kids, we're actually doing a case study with Harvard where we're doing a train the trainer with some teachers here locally to be able to do some civics engagement mm-hmm. along with civic engagement. But I think it's there's not a whole lot of apathy, but at the same time, Florida and particularly Orange County score really low when it comes to social capital.
Right.
And so that's volunteerism and really getting involved with the issues. But yet we have the largest league in the nation. Hmm. And so the people who are active are very active. And what I think is really important to keep in mind as we look at the league is the league isn't just one massive group of people. It's people who are working on different issues across committees, and it's kind of a bottom-up organization where there's many subject matter experts across our committees. And for those things that we don't know, we're constantly talking to and bringing in subject matter experts and inviting the public to be part of those conversations through our hot topics, mm-hmm. our speakeasies, and other educational events that we can share what we're doing and how people can get involved.
It's reassuring to hear you say that you don't think people are apathetic, but at the same time, if you look at turnout for local body elections, particularly like in the city of Orlando and some other municipalities across Central Florida, we just had an election. Turnout is pretty low.
Yes.
And, I mean, on one hand, that means that every vote does really count. One person can make a huge difference, but it shouldn't be that way. In a city the size of Orlando, you should have way higher turnout than you actually do. Why do you think that is?
I think a lot of people don't think their vote counts. That's one of the things that, you know, why does it matter? You know, I have to take the time, especially when they have to take time away from work
sure.
to be able to go out and vote. And, you know, I love early voting because of the opportunity to be able to vote on weekends. Every year, my husband and I vote on Halloween because it's...
Do you dress up to vote?
It's the best time to vote because the libraries are always clear of people. Everybody's out trick-or-treating. And I vote in every election that I can. And I think it's really important, and I've really encouraged my kids to do the same. But I think for a lot of people, when we think about it, we are a service economy where people are sometimes working 2 and 3 jobs.
Sure.
And if not, they may not have childcare. They may not be thinking, I can bring my child with me to vote, which my mom always did for me and I've done for my kids. So I think there's just a lot of things that people perceive as being barriers to voting, even though it shouldn't be that difficult.
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts, Linda, on turnout? And I'm wondering what you've seen over the years.
I think that the media can help us with turnout, perhaps not just by urging people to vote, but by pointing out that there have been elections, particularly in Florida, where a small number of votes made an enormous difference. In the 2000 election itself, Florida was a critical turnout. In the 2000,
I think a lot of people are trying to forget the election and the aftermath, right? I mean, the recount is kind of a stain in some ways on the history of the state.
Absolutely. In a number of very important elections, Florida has been split practically down the middle. And so you really do have to encourage people by telling them those stories. And we'll get you to help us tell those stories. We certainly tell them. But there's another thing that the League is very committed to. And I think in these particular times, this particular moment, there's a quote in the book from a long ago League member in 1939. And she says, "There's a new kind of citizen in the League of Women Voters, one who consciously tries to overcome her prejudices, who wants facts before forming opinions, and who takes the trouble to acquire them, one who actually has a living sense of personal responsibility for what government does."
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the League has always been about to me.
Sandy, as Linda was saying, this is kind of an important time to be thinking about politics and getting involved. I'm wondering what the League is planning for 2020 in the lead up, particularly to the presidential election.
There's quite a few things. We're going to have a very, very busy year. Our voter registration group, we have a voter services group, will be active and out all around the community for both voting events where we can register people to vote and then also opportunities to educate. We also will have a series of events that's being planned now with our history committee looking at our previous history, but also encouraging people to be involved with the future history. Mm-hmm. And then or future events, but that will become our history. And then we have also a speakers bureau that is out and always educating people. Whenever we're asked to talk on different subjects, particularly in the last major election, we were very involved with the amendments. And not just advocating for certain amendments, like Amendment 4 that's still up for a lot of discussion, but really making it as simple as possible and educating people about what those amendments mean, who's for them, who's against them. And then also we have a voter 411 guide where we take the time through our government committee to interview all of the people who are running that will answer our questions so that voters can be educated on where do people stand on certain issues.
What's your success rate in terms of getting people to answer those questions?
There's been quite a few who've answered the questions. There's some people who, for whatever reason, choose not to. And
by the way, Sandy, that's a change. Excuse me for interrupting. But there was a time when a candidate wouldn't dream of not responding to a League questionnaire. It's probably important, too, to point out that the League never endorses particular candidates.
Mm-hmm.
The League is nonpartisan, does not favor one party over another or ever recommend candidates. They only try and make sure that the candidates are responsive to the voters. I think a big part of the enormous success of the Orange County League in modern times, the largest league in the country, between 900 and 1,000 members at the moment. And I think a big part of that reason is because they are so good at what they do. Mm-hmm. And they know how to study, they know how to advocate, and if they have to fight, they know how to fight. But they do it always in a way that is appropriate to their mission and in support of the democratic way of running a government. That's what I love about the League. In addition to what Sandy said about what's coming up this next year, there will be a great big celebration all along the way with the speakers, bureaus, and so forth about the 100th anniversary of the ratification of the 19th Amendment. It's a huge step to recognize and certainly was the reason for the founding of the National League of Women Voters, which mm-hmm. also celebrates its 100th anniversary in that same year.
We've been speaking to Linda Chapin. She is a past president of the League of Women Voters of Orange County and former mayor of Orange County. Thank you so much, Linda.
Enjoyed it.
And also Sandy Vidal. She is the current president of the League of Women Voters of Orange County. Thank you as well.
Thank you.
And the book is called Warriors for Democracy, the story of the League of Women Voters of Orange County, Florida. Thank you again. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Elizabeth Gonda. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks to everyone who made a contribution to WMFE during our silent drive. Your support makes local programs like Intersection possible. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.